This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents The Darkest Part of the Forest, written by Holly Black, read by Lauren Fortgang. For Sarah Reese Brennan, a great friend and an inspiration. Come now, my child. If we were planning to harm you, do you think we'd be lurking here beside the path in the very darkest part of the forest? Kenneth Patchen. Chapter 1. Down a path worn into the woods, past a stream and a hollowed-out log full of pill bugs and termites, was a glass coffin. It rested right on the ground, and in it slept a boy with horns on his head and ears as pointed as knives. As far as Hazel Evans knew, from what her parents said to her and from what their parents said to them, he'd always been there. And no matter what anyone did, he never, ever woke up. He didn't wake up during the long summers, when Hazel and her brother Ben stretched out on the full length of the coffin, staring down through the crystalline panes, fogging them up with their breath, and scheming glorious schemes. He didn't wake up when tourists came to gape, or debunkers came to swear he wasn't real. He didn't wake up on autumn weekends, when girls danced right on top of him, gyrating to the tinny sounds coming from nearby iPod speakers. Didn't notice when Leonie Wallace lifted her beer high over her head, as if she were saluting the whole haunted forest. He didn't so much as stir when Ben's best friend, Jack Gordon, wrote, "In case of emergency, break glass," in Sharpie along one side. Or when Lloyd Lindblad took a sledgehammer and actually tried. No matter how many parties had been held around the horned boy, generations of parties, so that the grass sparkled with decades of broken bottles in green and amber, so that the bushes shone with crushed aluminum cans in silver and gold and rust, and no matter what happened at those parties, nothing could wake the boy inside the glass coffin. When they were little, Ben and Hazel made him flower crowns and told him stories about how they would rescue him. Back then, they were going to save everyone who needed saving in Fairfold. Once Hazel got older, though, she mostly visited the coffin only at night, in crowds. But she still felt something tighten in her chest when she looked down at the boy's strange and beautiful face. She hadn't saved him, and she hadn't saved Fairfold either. "Hey, Hazel," Leonie called, dancing to one side to make room in case Hazel wanted to join her atop the horned boy's casket. Doris Alvaro was already up there, still in her cheerleader outfit from the game their school lost earlier that night, shining chestnut ponytail whipping through the air. They both looked flushed with alcohol and good cheer. Waving a hello to Leonie, Hazel didn't get up on the coffin, although she was tempted. Instead, she threaded her way through the crowd of teenagers. Fairfold High was a small enough school that although there were cliques, even if a few were made up basically of a single person, like how Megan Rojas was the entire goth community, everyone had to party together if they wanted to have enough people around to party at all. But just because everyone partied together, it didn't mean they were all friends. Until a month ago, Hazel had been part of a girl posse, striding through school in heavy eyeliner and dangling shining earrings as sharp as their smiles. Sworn in sticky, bright blood sucked from thumbs to be friends forever. She had drifted away from them after Molly Lipscomb asked her to kiss and then jilt Molly's ex, but was furious with her once she had. It turned out that Hazel's other friends were really just Molly's friends. Even though they'd been part of the plan, they pretended they weren't. They pretended something had happened that Hazel ought to be sorry about. They wanted Hazel to admit that she'd done it to hurt Molly. Hazel kissed boys for all kinds of reasons. Because they were cute, because she was a little drunk, because she was bored, because they let her, because it was fun, because they looked lonely, because it blotted out her fears for a while, because she wasn't sure how many kisses she had left. But she'd kissed only one boy who really belonged to someone else, and under no circumstances would she ever do it again. At least she still had her brother to hang out with, even if he was currently on a date in the city with some guy he'd met online. And she had Ben's best friend, Jack, even if he made her nervous. and she had Leonie. That was plenty of friends. Too many, really, considering that she was likely to disappear one of these days, leaving them all behind. Thinking that way was how she'd wound up not asking anyone for a ride to the party that night, even though it meant walking the whole way, through the shallow edge of the woods, past farms and old tobacco barns, and then into the forest. It was one of those early fall nights, when wood smoke was in the air along with the sweet richness of kicked-up leaf mold, and everything felt possible. She was wearing a new green sweater, her favorite brown boots, and a pair of cheap green enamel hoops. Her loose red curls still had a hint of summer gold, and when she'd looked in the mirror to smear on a little bit of tinted chapstick before she walked out the door, she actually thought she looked pretty good. Liz was in charge of the playlist, broadcasting from her phone through the speakers in her vintage Fiat, choosing dance music so loud it made the trees shiver. Martin Silver was chatting up Lourdes and Namiya at the same time, clearly hoping for a best friend sandwich that was never, ever, ever going to happen. Molly was laughing in a half circle of girls. Stephen, in his paint-spattered shirt, was sitting on his truck with the headlights on, drinking Franklin's dad's moonshine from a flask, too busy nursing some private sorrow to care whether the stuff would make him go blind. Jack was sitting over with his brother, well, kind of his brother, Carter, the quarterback, on a log near the glass coffin. They were laughing, which made Hazel want to go over there and laugh with them, except that she also wanted to get up and dance, and she also wanted to run back home.
"Hazel,"
someone said, and she turned to see Robbie Delmonico. The smile froze on her face.
"I haven't seen you around. You look nice."
He seemed resentful about it. "Thanks." Robbie had to know she'd been avoiding him, which made her feel like an awful person, but ever since they'd made out at a party, he'd followed her around as though he was heartbroken, and that was even worse. She hadn't dumped him or anything like that. He'd never even asked her out. He just stared at her miserably and asked weird leading questions, such as,
"What are you doing after school?"
And when she told him, "Nothing, just hanging out," he never suggested anything else, never even proposed he might like to come over. It was because of kissing boys like Robbie Delmonico that people believed Hazel would kiss anyone. It really had seemed like a good idea at the time. "Thanks," she said again, slightly more loudly, nodding. She began to turn away.
"Your sweater's new, right?"
And he gave her that sad smile that seemed to say that he knew he was nice for noticing and that he knew nice guys finished last. The funny thing was that he hadn't seemed particularly interested in her before she lunged at him. It was as though by putting her lips to his and, okay, allowing a certain amount of handsiness, she'd transformed herself into some kind of cruel goddess of love. "It is new," she told him, nodding again. Around him, she felt as cold-hearted as he clearly thought she was. "Well, I guess I'll see you around."
"Yeah,"
he said, letting the word linger. And then, at the critical moment, the moment when she meant to just walk away, guilt overtook her, and she said the one thing she knew she shouldn't say, the thing for which she would kick herself over and over again throughout the night. "Maybe we'll run into each other later." Hope lit his eyes, and too late, she realized how he'd taken it, as a promise. But by then, all she could do was hightail it over to Jack and Carter. Jack, the crush of Hazel's younger, sillier years, looked surprised when she stumbled up, which was odd because he was almost never caught off guard. As his mother once said about him, Jack could hear the thunder before the lightning bothered to strike.
"Hazel, Hazel, blue of eye, kissed the boys and made them cry," Carter said, because Carter could be a jerk.
Carter and Jack looked almost exactly alike, as if they were twins. Same dark, curly hair, same amber eyes, same deep brown skin and lush mouths and wide cheekbones that were the envy of every girl in town. They weren't twins, though. Jack was a changeling. Carter's changeling, left behind when Carter got stolen away by the fairies. Fairfold was a strange place. Dead in the center of the Carling Forest, the haunted forest, full of what Hazel's grandfather called greenies, and what her mother called they themselves, or the folk of the air. In these woods, it wasn't odd to see a black hare swimming in the creek, although rabbits don't usually much care for swimming, or to spot a deer that became a sprinting girl in the blink of an eye. Every autumn, a portion of the harvest apples was left out for the cruel and capricious Alder King. Flower garlands were threaded for him every spring. Townsfolk knew to fear the monster coiled in the heart of the forest, who lured tourists with a cry that sounded like a woman weeping. Its fingers were sticks, its hair moss. It fed on sorrow and sowed corruption. You could lure it out with a sing-song chant, the kind girls dare one another to say at birthday sleepovers. Plus, there was a hawthorn tree in a ring of stones where you could bargain for your heart's desire by tying a strip of your clothing to the branches under a full moon and waiting for one of the folk to come. The year before, Jenny Eichmann had gone out there and wished herself into Princeton, promising to pay anything the fairies wanted. She'd gotten in, too, but her mother had a stroke and died the same day the letter came. Which was why, between the wishes and the horned boy and the odd sightings, even though Fairfold was so tiny that the kids in kindergarten went to school in an adjacent building to the seniors, and that you had to go three towns over to buy a new washing machine or stroll through a mall, the town still got plenty of tourists. Other places had the biggest ball of twine, or a very large wheel of cheese, or a chair big enough for a giant. They had scenic waterfalls, or shimmering caves full of jagged stalactites, or bats that slept beneath a bridge. Fairfold had the boy in the glass coffin. Fairfold had the folk. And to the folk, tourists were fair game. Maybe that's what they had thought Carter's parents were. Carter's dad was from out of town, but Carter's mom was no tourist. It took a single night for her to realize that her baby had been stolen. And she'd known just what to do. She sent her husband out of the house for the day and invited over a bunch of neighbor ladies. They'd baked bread and chopped wood and filled an old earthenware bowl with salt. Then, when everything was done, Carter's mom heated a poker in the fireplace. First it turned red, but she did nothing. It was only once the metal glowed white that she pressed the very tip of the poker against the changeling's shoulder. It shrieked with pain, its voice spiraling so high that both kitchen windows shattered. There'd been a smell like when you toss fresh grass onto a fire, and the baby's skin turned bright, bubbling red. The burn left a scar, too. Hazel had seen it when she and Jack and Ben and Carter went swimming last summer, stretched out by growing but still there. Burning a changeling summons its mother. She arrived on the threshold moments later, a swaddled bundle in her arms. According to the stories, she was thin and tall, her hair the brown of autumn leaves, her skin the color of bark, with eyes that changed from moment to moment, molten silver to owl gold, to dull and gray as stone. There was no mistaking her for human.
"You don't take our children," said Carter's mother, or at least that was how the story Hazel heard went, and she'd heard the story a lot. "You don't spirit us away or make us sick. That's how things have worked around here for generations, and that's how things are going to keep on working."
The fairy woman seemed to shrink back a little. As if in answer, she silently held out the child she'd brought, wrapped up in blankets, sleeping as peacefully as if he were in his own bed.
"Take him," she said.
Carter's mother crushed him to her, drinking in the ripeness of his sour milk smell. She said that was the one thing the folk of the air couldn't fake. The other baby just hadn't smelled like Carter. Then the fairy woman had reached out her arms for her own wailing child, but the neighbor woman holding him stepped back. Carter's mother blocked the way.
"You can't have him," said Carter's mother, passing her own baby to her sister and picking up iron filings and red berries and salt, protection against the fairy woman's magic. "If you were willing to trade him away even for an hour, then you don't deserve him. I'll keep them both to raise as my own. And let that be our judgment on you for breaking oath with us."
At that, the elf woman spoke in a voice like wind and rain and brittle leaves snapping underfoot.
"You do not have the lessening of us. You have no power, no claim. Give me my child,
and I will place a blessing on your house, but if you keep him, you will come to regret it.
Damn the consequences, and damn you too, said Carter's mom, according to everyone who has ever told this story. Get the hell out!
And so, even though some of the neighbor ladies grumbled about Carter's mother borrowing trouble, that was how Jack came to live with Carter's family, and to become Carter's brother and Ben's best friend. That was how they all got so used to Jack that no one was surprised anymore by how his ears tapered to small points, or how his eyes shone silver sometimes, or the way he could predict the weather better than any weatherman on the news.
So, do you think Ben's having a better time than we are?
Jack asked her, forcing her thoughts away from his past and his scar and his handsome face. If Hazel took kissing boys too lightly, then Ben never took it lightly enough. He wanted to be in love, was all too willing to give away his still-beating heart. Ben had always been like that, even when it cost him more than she wanted to think about. However, even he didn't have much luck online. I think Ben's date will be boring. Hazel took the beer can from Jack's hand and swigged. It tasted sour. Most of them are boring, even the liars, especially the liars. I don't know why he bothers. Carter shrugged.
Sex?
He likes stories, Jack said, with a conspiratorial grin in her direction. Hazel licked the foam off her upper lip, some of her previous good cheer returning. Yeah, I guess. Carter stood eyeing Megan Rojas, who'd just arrived with freshly purpled hair, carrying a bottle of cinnamon schnapps, the pointed heels of her spiderweb-stitched boots sinking into the soft earth.
I'm going to get another beer. You want something?
Hazel stole mine, Jack said, nodding toward her. The thick silver hoops in his ears glinted in the moonlight.
So grab another round for us both. Try not to break any hearts while I'm gone,
Carter told Hazel as if he was joking, but his tone wasn't entirely friendly. Hazel sat down on the part of the log that Carter had vacated, looking at the girls dancing and the other kids drinking. She felt outside of it all, purposeless and adrift. Once she'd had a quest, one she'd been willing to give up everything for. But it turned out that some quests couldn't be won just by giving things up.
Don't listen to him, Jack told her as soon as his brother was safely on the other side of the casket and out of hearing range. You didn't do anything wrong with Rob. Anyone who offers up their heart on a silver platter deserves what they get.
Hazel thought of Ben and wondered if that was true.
I just keep making the same mistake, she said. I go to a party and I kiss some guy who I would never think of kissing at school. Guys I don't even really like. It's as though out here in the woods they're going to reveal some secret side of themselves. But they're always just the same.
It's just kissing.
He grinned at her, his mouth twisted up on one side. And something twisted inside her in response. His smiles and Carter's smiles were nothing alike.
It's fun. You're not hurting anybody. It's not like you're stabbing boys just to make something happen around here.
That surprised a laugh out of her.
Maybe you should tell that to Carter.
She didn't explain that she wasn't so much wanting something to happen as not wanting to be the only one with a secret self to reveal. Jack draped an arm over her shoulder, pretend flirting. It was friendly, funny.
He's my brother, so I can tell you definitively that he's an idiot. You must amuse yourself however you can among the dull folk of Fairfold.
She shook her head, smiling, and then turned toward him. He stopped speaking, and she realized how close their faces had become. Close enough that she could feel the warmth of his breath against her cheek. Close enough to watch the dark fringe of his eyelashes turn gold in the reflected light, and to see the soft bow of his mouth. Hazel's heart started pounding, her 10-year-old self's crush coming back with a vengeance. It made her feel just as vulnerable and silly as she'd felt back then. She hated that feeling. She was the one who broke hearts now, not the other way around. Anyone who offers up their heart on a silver platter deserves what they get. There was only one way to get over a boy. Only one way that ever worked. Jack's gaze was slightly unfocused, his lips slightly apart.
It seemed exactly right to close the distance between them, to shut her eyes and press her mouth to his. Warm and gentle, he pressed back for a single, shared exchange of breath. Then he pulled away, blinking.
Hazel, I didn't mean for you.
No, she said, leaping up, her cheeks hot. He was her friend, her brother's best friend. He mattered. It would never be okay to kiss him, even if he wanted her to, which he clearly did not, and which made everything much worse.
Of course not. Sorry. Sorry.
I told you I shouldn't go around kissing people, and here I am, doing it again. She backed away.
Wait, he started, reaching to catch her arm, but she didn't want to stay around while he tried to find the right words to let her down easy.
Hazel fled, passing Carter with her head down so she didn't have to see his knowing told-you-so look. She felt stupid and worse, like she deserved to be rejected, like it served her right. It was the kind of karmic justice that didn't usually happen in real life, or at least didn't usually happen so fast. Hazel headed straight for Franklin.
"Can I have some of that?" she asked him, pointing to the metal flask.
He looked at her blearily through bloodshot eyes, but held the flask out.
"You won't like it."
She didn't. The moonshine burned all the way down her throat, but she slugged back two more swallows, hoping that she could forget everything that had happened since she'd arrived at the party. Hoping that Jack would never tell Ben what she'd done. Hoping Jack would pretend it hadn't happened. She just wished she could undo everything, unravel time like yarn from a sweater. Across the clearing, illuminated by Stephen's headlights, Tom Mullins, linebacker and general rageaholic, leaped up onto the glass coffin suddenly enough to make the girls hop off. He looked completely wasted, face flushed and hair sticking up with sweat.
"Hey!"
he shouted, jumping up and down, stomping like he was trying to crack the glass.
"Hey! Wakey, wakey, eggs and bakey! Come on, you ancient fuck, get up!"
"Quit it," said Martin, waving for Tom to get down.
"Remember what happened to Lloyd?"
Lloyd was the kind of bad kid who liked to start fires and carried a knife to school. When teachers were taking attendance, they were hard-pressed to remember whether he wasn't there because he was cutting class or because he was suspended. One night last spring, Lloyd took a sledgehammer to the glass coffin. It didn't shatter, but the next time Lloyd set a fire, he got burned. He was still in a hospital in Philadelphia, where they had to graft skin from his ass onto his face. Some people said the horned boy had done that to Lloyd, because he didn't like it when people messed with his coffin. Others said that whoever had cursed the horned boy had cursed the glass, too, so if anyone tried to break it, that person would bring bad luck on themselves. Though Tom Mullins knew all that, he didn't seem to care. Hazel knew just how he felt.
"Get up!" he yelled, kicking and stomping and jumping. "Hey, lazy bones, time to wake up!"
Carter grabbed his arm.
"Tom, come on. We're going to do shots. You don't want to miss this."
Tom looked unsure.
"Come on," Carter repeated. "Unless you're too drunk already."
"Yeah," said Martin, trying to sound convincing.
"Maybe you can't hold your booze, Tom."
That did it. Tom scrambled down, lumbering away from the coffin, protesting that he could drink more than the both of them combined.
"So,"
Franklin said to Hazel,
"just another dull night in Fairfold where everyone's a lunatic or an elf."
She took one more drink from the silver flask. She was starting to get used to the feeling that her esophagus was on fire.
"Pretty much,"
he grinned, red-rimmed eyes dancing.
"Want to make out?"
From the look of him, he was as miserable as Hazel was. Franklin, who'd barely spoken for the first 3 years of grammar school and who everyone was sure ate roadkill for dinner sometimes. Franklin, who wouldn't thank her if she asked him what was bothering him, since she'd wager he had almost as much to forget as she did. Hazel felt a little bit lightheaded and a lot reckless.
"Okay."
As they walked away from the truck and into the woods, she glanced back at the party in the grove. Jack was watching her with an unreadable expression on his face. She turned away. Passing under an oak tree, Franklin's hand in hers, Hazel thought she saw the branches shift above her like fingers, but when she looked again,
All she saw were shadows.
Chapter 2 The summer when Ben was a baby and Hazel was still in their mother's belly, their mother went out to a clearing in the woods to paint en plein air. She spread out her blanket over the grass and sat Ben, slathered in SPF 50 and gumming a chunk of Zweibeck, on it while she daubed her canvas with cadmium orange and alizarin crimson. She painted for the better part of an hour before she noticed a woman watching from the cool shadows of the nearby trees. The woman, Mom said when she told the story, had her brown hair pulled back in a kerchief and carried a basket of young green apples.
"You're a true artist," the woman told her, crouching down and smiling delightedly.
That was when Mom noticed her loose dress was hand-loomed and very fine. For a moment, Mom thought she was one of those ladies who got into homesteading and canned stuff from her garden, kept chickens, and sewed her own clothes. But then she saw that the woman's ears rose to slim, delicate points, and realized she was one of the folk of the air, tricksy and dangerous. As is the tragedy of so many artists, Mom was more fascinated than afraid. Mom had grown up in Fairfold, had heard endless stories about the folk, had known about the nest of redcaps who dipped their hats in fresh human blood and who were rumored to live near an old cave on the far side of town. She'd heard about a snake woman, sometimes spotted in the cool of the evening near the edges of the woods. She knew of the monster made of dry branches, tree bark, dirt, and moss, who turned the blood of those she touched to sap. She remembered the song they sang while they skipped rope as girls. "There's a monster in our wood. She'll get you if you're not good. Drag you under leaves and sticks. Punish you for all your tricks. A nest of hair and gnawed bone. You are never, ever coming." They'd shouted it with great glee, never saying the last word. If they had, the monster might have been summoned. That was what it was supposed to do, after all. But as long as they never finished the song, the magic wouldn't work. But not all the stories were terrible. The generosity of the folk was as great as their cruelty. There was a little girl in Ben's playgroup whose doll was stolen by a Nixie. A week later, that same girl woke in her crib with ropes of gorgeous freshwater pearls wound around her neck. That was why Fairfold was special, because it was so close to magic. Dangerous magic, yes, but magic all the same. Food tasted better in Fairfold, people said, infused as it was with enchantment. Dreams were more vivid, artists were more inspired, and their work more beautiful. People fell more deeply in love, music was more pleasing to the ear, and ideas came more frequently than in other places. "Let me draw you," Mom said, pulling her sketchbook from her bag, along with some charcoals. She thought she drew better in Fairfold, too. The woman demurred.
"Draw my beautiful apples instead. They are already given over to rot, while I will remain as I am for all the long years of my life."
The words sent a shiver down Mom's spine. The woman saw her face and laughed.
"Oh, yes, I have seen the acorn before the tree. I have seen the egg before the hen, and I will see them all again."
Mom took a deep breath and tried again to persuade her.
"If you allow me to draw you, I'll give you the picture once it's done."
The elf woman considered this for a long moment.
"I may have it."
Mom nodded. The woman assented. And Mom got to work. All the while that Mom sketched, they spoke of their lives. The woman said she had once belonged to an easterly court, but had followed one of the gentry into exile. She told Mom of her newfound love of the deepness of the forest, but also of her longing for her old life. In turn, Mom told her of her fears about her first child, who'd grown fussy and bored, whimpering on his blanket and in need of a new diaper. Would Ben grow up to be someone completely unlike her? Someone who would be uninterested in the arts, someone dull and conventional? Mom's parents had been disappointed in her again and again because she wasn't like them. What if she felt that same way about Ben? When Mom was done with the drawing, the elf woman drew in her breath at the loveliness of it. She knelt down on the blanket beside the baby and brought her thumb to his temple. Immediately, he began to howl. Mom grabbed for the woman. "What have you done?" she cried. On her son's brow, a red stain was spreading in the shape of a fingertip.
"For the gift of your drawing, I owe you a boon."
The woman rose, towering above Mom, taller than seemed possible, while Mom wrapped her arms around a squalling Ben.
"I can't change his nature, but I can give him the gift of our music. He will play music so sweet that no one will be able to think of anything else when they hear it. Music that contains the magic of fairy. It will weigh on him, and it will change him, and it will make him an artist, no matter what else he desires. Every child needs tragedy to become truly interesting. That is my gift to you. He will be compelled to art, love it or no."
With that, the elf woman took her drawing and left my mother huddled on her blanket, weeping, arms around Ben. She wasn't sure if her son had been cursed or blessed. The answer turned out to be both. But Hazel, floating in the tideless sea of amniotic fluid, was neither. Her tragedy, if she had one, was to be as normal and average as any child ever born. Chapter 3 Hazel got home from the party late that night to find Ben eating cereal at the kitchen table, dragging his spoon through the milk to scoop up the last pieces of granola. It was a little after midnight, but their parents were still awake and still working. Light blazed from the windows of their shared art studio out back. Sometimes when they were inspired, or on deadline, one of them even wound up sleeping out there. Hazel didn't mind. She was proud of the ways they were different from other people's parents. They'd raised her to be
normal people, they'd say with a shudder. Normal people think they're happy, but that's because they're too dumb to know any different. Better to be miserable and interesting, right, kiddo? Then they'd laugh.
Sometimes, though, when Hazel walked around their studio, breathing in the familiar smells of turpentine and varnish and fresh paint, she wondered what it would be like to have happy, normal, dumb parents, and then she felt guilty for wondering. Ben looked up at her with cornflower blue eyes and black brows like her own. His red hair was messier than usual, the loose curls disheveled. There was a leaf stuck in it. Hazel moved to pluck it out, grinning. She was drunk enough to feel blurry around the edges, and her mouth was a bit abraded from the way Franklin had mashed his lips against hers, all details she wanted to be distracted from. She didn't want to remember any of the night, not Jack, nor how much of an idiot she'd been, not any of it. She pictured a huge trunk slamming down on those memories, a padlock coiling around the trunk, and then the trunk falling to the bottom of the sea.
"So, how was your date?" she asked him.
He gave a long sigh, then pushed his bowl away across the worn tablecloth.
"Basically awful."
Hazel put her head down on the table, looking over at him. He seemed insubstantial from that angle, as though if she squinted, she might be able to see right through him.
"Was he into something weird?"
"Rubber suits? Clown costumes? Rubber clown costumes?"
"He was not."
Ben didn't laugh. His smile had gone a bit strained. Hazel frowned.
"Are you okay? Did something..."
"No, not like that." Ben spoke quickly, shaking off her concern.
"We went back to his apartment and his ex was there, as in his ex still lived there."
She smothered a gasp because that did sound awful.
"Seriously? He didn't mention that beforehand?"
"He said he had an ex. Full stop. Everyone has an ex, even me. I mean, you have, what, millions?" He grinned, so she'd know he was kidding. Hazel wasn't in the mood for that particular joke.
"Can't have an ex if you never go on a date," she said. "Anyway, we go in the door, and this guy is sitting in front of the television looking crushed, like, clearly he's not okay with my being there, and clearly he wasn't prepared for it either. My date, meanwhile, is talking about how his ex is cool and he'll even sleep on the couch so we can hang out in the bedroom, which is how I realize there's only one bedroom in the apartment. Right then, I decide that I have to get out of there, but what am I supposed to do? I feel like I can't say anything because that would be rude. Mutually constructed reality, the social contract, something, I just can't.
Hazel snorted, but he ignored her.
So I say I have to go to the bathroom and hide in there, trying to get my nerve up. Then I take a breath, I walk out, and just keep going until I'm through the apartment door and down the stairs. When I hit the sidewalk, I book it.
She laughed, picturing him enacting this less-than-subtle plan. Because running away isn't rude at all.
Ben shook his head solemnly.
Less awkward.
That made her laugh harder.
Have you checked your email? I mean, he's going to write and ask where you went. Won't that be awkward?
Are you kidding? I am never going to check my email again, Ben said with feeling.
Good, said Hazel. Boys on the internet lie.
All boys lie, Ben said. And all girls lie, too. I lie. You lie. Don't pretend you don't.
Hazel didn't say anything because he was right. She'd lied. She'd lied a lot, especially to Ben.
So how about you? How was our prince tonight? He asked.
Over the years, Hazel and Ben had made up a lot of stories about the horned boy. They'd both drawn endless pictures of his beautiful face and curving horns with Dad's markers, Mom's charcoals, and before that, their own crayons. If Hazel closed her eyes, she could conjure the image of him, his midnight blue doublet stitched with dark gold thread, picking out phoenixes, griffins, and dragons. Pale hands folded over each other, each adorned with glittering rings, nails unusually long and subtly pointed, boots of ivory leather that came to his calves, and a face so beautiful, with features so perfectly shaped that looking at him for too long made you feel as though everything else you saw was unbearably shabby. He must be a prince. That was what Ben had decided when they first saw him, a prince like the ones in fairy tales, with curses that could be broken by their true loves. And back then, Hazel was sure she would be the one to wake him.
Our prince was the same, Hazel said, not wanting to talk about the night, but not wanting to be obvious about it either. Everyone was the same. Everything was the same.
She knew it wasn't Ben's fault that she got frustrated by her life. Her bargains were made. There was no point in regretting them, and even less point in resenting him. After a while, their dad staggered in from the studio to make a cup of tea and shooed them off to bed. Dad was on deadline, trying to finish up the illustrations he was supposed to drive to the city with on Monday. He was likely to stay up all night, which meant he'd notice if they stayed up too. Mom was probably keeping him company. Mom and Dad had started dating in art school in Philadelphia, bound by a love of kids' books that led to Ben and Hazel both being named, humiliatingly, after famous rabbits. Soon after graduation, Mom and Dad moved back to Fairfold, broke, pregnant, and willing to get married if that meant Dad's family would let them live rent-free in his great-aunt's farmhouse. Dad converted the barn behind it into a studio and used his half to paint illustrations for picture books, while Mom used hers to paint landscapes of the Carling Forest that she sold in town, mostly to tourists. In the spring and summer, Fairfold was clogged with tourists. You could spot them eating pancakes with real maple syrup over at the railway diner, picking up T-shirts and paperweights with clover suspended in resin at Curious Curios, getting their fortunes told at Mystical Moon Tarot, taking selfies sitting on the prince's glass casket, picking up sandwich boxes from Annie's Luncheonette for impromptu picnics out near White Lake, or strolling hand-in-hand through the streets, acting as though Fairfold was the quaintest and kookiest place they'd ever been. Every year, some of those tourists disappeared. Some got dragged down into White Lake by water hags, bodies cracking the dense mat of algae, scattering the duckweed. Some would be run down at twilight by horses with ringing bells tied to their manes, and members of the Shining Folk on their backs. Some would be found strung upside down in trees, bled out, and chewed upon. Some would be found sitting on park benches, their faces frozen in a grimace so terrible that it seemed as though they must have died of fright, and some would simply be gone. Not many, one or two each season.
but enough that someone should have noticed outside Fairfold. Enough that there should have been warnings, travel advisories, something. Enough that tourists should have stopped coming. They didn't. A generation ago, the folk had been more circumspect, more inclined toward pranks. A stray wind might grab an idle tourist, sweep her up into the air and deposit her miles away. A few tourists might stagger back to their hotel after a late night, only to realize 6 months had passed. Occasionally one would wake up with his or her hair in knots. Things they'd been sure were in their pockets were missing, strange new things were discovered. Butter was eaten right off a dish, licked up by invisible tongues. Money turned to leaves, laces wouldn't untie, and shadows looked a bit ragged, as though they had slipped away for some fun. Back then, it was very rare for someone to die because of the folk. Tourists, the locals would say, a sneer in their voices, and they still did, because everyone believed. Everyone had to believe tourists did stupid things that got them killed, and if someone from Fairfold very occasionally went missing too, well, they must have been acting like a tourist. They should have known better. The people of Fairfold came to think of the folk as inevitable, a natural hazard, like hailstorms, or getting swept out to sea by a riptide. It was a strange kind of double consciousness. They had to be respectful of the folk, but not scared. Tourists were scared. They had to stay clear of the folk and carry protections. Tourists weren't scared enough. When Hazel and Ben lived briefly in Philadelphia, no one believed their stories. Those 2 years had been bizarre. They had to learn to hide their strangeness. But coming back had been difficult, too, because by then, they knew how weird Fairfold was compared with places outside it. And because, by the time they'd returned, Ben had decided to give up his magic and his music entirely, which meant he could never, ever know the price Hazel had paid for them to go in the first place. After all, she wasn't a tourist. She should have known better. But sometimes, on nights like the one she just had, she wished she could tell someone. She wished she didn't always have to be so alone. That night, after she and Ben went up to bed, after she stripped off her clothes and got into her pajamas, after she brushed her teeth and checked to make sure the scattered bits of salted oatmeal were still under her pillow where they might keep her safe from fairy tricks. Then Hazel had nothing left to distract her from remembering the dizzying moment when her mouth had met Jack's. Only, as she slid off into dreams, it wasn't Jack she was kissing anymore, but the horned boy. His eyes were open, and when she pulled him closer, he didn't push her away. Hazel woke up feeling out of sorts, restless and melancholy. She put it down to drinking the night before and swigged back some aspirin with the last dregs of a carton of orange juice. Her mom had left a note to pick up bread and milk, clothespin to a $10 bill, in the giant pottery catch-all bowl that sat in the center of the kitchen table. With a groan, Hazel went back upstairs to put on leggings and a baggy black shirt. She shoved the green hoops back into her ears. Music was on in Ben's room. Even though he didn't play anymore, Ben always had a continuous soundtrack in the background, even as he slept. If he was up, though, she hoped she could persuade him to run Mom's errand so that she could go back to bed. Hazel knocked on Ben's door. "Enter at your own risk," he called. Hazel opened it to find him holding a cell phone up to his ear as he hopped his way into a pair of mustard-colored skinny jeans. "Hey," she said, "can you—" He waved her over, speaking into the phone. "Yeah, she's up. She's right in front of me. Sure, we'll meet you in 15 minutes. Hazel groaned.
"What are you agreeing to?"
He tossed an easy grin in her direction and said goodbye to the person on the other end of his cell, the person she was pretty sure was Jack. Ben and Jack had been friends for years, through Ben coming out and his obsessive relationship with the only other out boy at school, which ended in a huge public fight at the homecoming bonfire, through Jack's bleak depression after being dumped by Amanda Watkins, who told him that she was dating him only because she really wanted to date Carter, and dating him was like dating Carter's shadow, through both of them liking different music and different books, and hanging out with different people at lunch.
Surely, a little thing like her kissing Jack wouldn't even ripple the waters. But that didn't make her eager for the moment Ben found out what she'd done. And she wasn't looking forward to Jack's watching her warily all afternoon as though she might lunge at him or something. But despite herself, she was looking forward to seeing him again. She couldn't quite believe they'd kissed, even just for a moment. The memory filled her with an embarrassing jolt of happiness. It felt like an act of real daring, the first she'd committed in a long time. It was a horrible mistake, of course. She could have wrecked things. She hoped she hadn't wrecked things. She could never do it again. At least, she couldn't think of a way it would be possible to do it again. Hazel wasn't sure when her crush on Jack had started. It had been a slow thing, an exaggerated awareness of him, a thrill at his attention, accompanied by a constant stream of nervous chatter when he was around. But she remembered when her crush had become acute. She'd walked over to remind Ben he was supposed to be home for a music lesson with one of Dad's deadbeat friends, and found a whole group of boys in the Gordon kitchen, making sandwiches and goofing around. Jack had made her one with chicken salad and carefully sliced tomato. When he was turned away to get her some pretzels, she had snatched his partially chewed gum from where it was stuck to a plate and shoved it into her mouth. It had tasted of strawberry and his spit, and had given her the same pure shock of agonized happiness that kissing him had. That gum was still stuck to her bed frame, a talisman she couldn't quite give up. "We're going to Lucky's," Ben offered, as though maybe he should inform her of the place she hadn't agreed to go. "We'll get some coffee, listen to records, see if any new stuff came in. Come on, Mr. Schroeder probably misses you. Besides, as you are so fond of pointing out, what else is there to do in this town on a Sunday?" Hazel sighed. She should tell him no, but instead she seemed to be running toward trouble, leaving no stone unturned, no boy unkissed, no crush abandoned, and no bad idea unembraced. "I guess I could use some coffee," she said as her brother picked up a red blazer, apparently matching his outfit to a sunrise. Lucky's was in a big, old, restored warehouse on the duller end of Main Street beside the bank, the dentist's office, and a shop that sold clocks. The place smelled like the dust of old books, mothballs, and French roast. Mismatched shelves filled the walls and defined the aisles down the center. Some of the bookshelves were carved oak, others were nailed together from pallets, and all had been picked up for cheap at garage sales by old Mr. and Mrs. Schroeder, who ran the place. Two overstuffed chairs and a record player sat beside big windows that overlooked a wide stream. Customers could play any of the old vinyl albums in stock. Two big thermal dispensers held organic fair trade coffee. Mugs sat on a painted table with a chipped jar beside them marked Honor System, 50 cents a cup. And on the other side of the room were racks and racks of second-hand clothes, shoes, purses, and other accessories. Hazel had worked there over the summer, and a big part of her job had been going through what seemed like hundreds of garbage bags in the back, sorting what could go on the shelves from stuff that was ripped or stained or had an unpleasant smell. She'd found a lot of good stuff hunting through those bags. Lucky's was more expensive than Goodwill, which was where her parents liked for her to shop, claiming that buying things new was for the bourgeois. But it was nicer, too, and she got a discount. Jack, whose family definitely qualified as bourgeois to Hazel's parents, and who bought his clothes new from the mall, came to Lucky's for stacks of biographies of the obscurely famous, which he read with the frequency other people smoked cigarettes. Ben came for the old records, which he loved, even though they skipped and hissed and degraded over time, because he said the grooves mirrored the sound's original waveform. He claimed they gave a truer, richer sound. Hazel believed that what he truly loved was the ritual, though. Taking the vinyl out of the sleeve, placing it on the turntable, bringing down the needle in just the right place, and then balling his hands into fists so he wouldn't tap out the notes against his thigh. Well, he might not love that last part, but he did it. Every time. The day was bright and chilly, the wind slapping their cheeks on the walk over, turning them rosy.
As Hazel and Ben entered the shop, a dozen crows rose from a fir tree, cawing as they flew up into the sky. Mr. Schroeder looked up from where he was napping when the bell over the door jingled. He winked at Hazel, and she gave him a wink in return. He grinned as he slumped back into his armchair. On the other end of the room, Jack was putting a Nick Drake album on the turntable. His sonorous voice filled the shop, whispering about golden crowns and silence. Hazel tried to study Jack without his noticing, gauging his mood. He was his usual slightly rumpled self, wearing jeans, two-tone Oxfords, and a wrinkled green shirt that seemed to bring out the silver shine of his eyes. When he saw Hazel and Ben, he smiled, but was Hazel imagining that his smile looked a little forced and didn't quite reach his eyes? Either way, it didn't matter, because his gaze slid over her and went to her brother.
"So what's all this about ditching your date like Bruce Wayne after spotting the bat signal?"
Ben laughed.
"That's not what happened."
What had she been thinking, kissing him? Just because she'd had a crush on him when they were kids? Just because she'd wanted to?
"Yeah," she forced herself to say. "Batman would never ditch."
Ben was happy to tell the story of his disastrous date again. They scrounged up change for Honor System Coffee as Ben's new version became more exaggerated and dramatic. The roommate was even more wildly in love with Ben's date and even more furious at Ben. Ben was even more comically incompetent at sneaking out. By the end, Hazel had no idea how much of it was true anymore, and she didn't care. It reminded her of how compellingly Ben could tell a story, and how many of her most beloved tales about the Horned Boy had been ones he'd made up.
"So, what about you guys?" Ben asked finally. "Hazel says nothing even remotely interesting happened last night."
Jack's laugh stopped.
"Oh,"
he said after a pause that was just a couple of seconds too long. There was an odd light in his amber eyes.
"She didn't tell you."
Hazel froze. Her brother was watching them curiously, brow furrowed.
"Well, what?" "Tom Mullins got wasted, climbed up on the glass coffin, and tried to smash it. He's cursed for sure, poor bastard."
Jack's smile was tilted, rueful. He ran his fingers over his tight brown curls, rumpling them. Hazel let out her breath a little dizzily. Ben shook his head.
"What makes people do that? Bad stuff happens whenever somebody messes around with the coffin. Tommy doesn't care about the prince, so what's the temptation?"
He looked honestly frustrated. But then Ben and Tom Mullins used to be friends, before Ben moved away and Tom became a drunk.
"Maybe he was tired of the same old parties and the same old people,"
Jack said, perching on a table arranged with stacks of books, belts, and scarves, and looking at Hazel.
"Maybe he wanted something to happen."
She winced.
"Okay, enough with the weirdness,"
Ben said, leaning forward in his chair, cradling his cup. His red curls looked gold in the light filtering through the dirty window panes.
"What's wrong with you guys? You keep staring at each other like creepers."
"What? No," said Jack softly.
"Nothing's wrong."
Hazel shook her head, going to refill her coffee cup.
"Huh,"
she said, eager for a subject change. "Is that a sequined tube top I spy with my little eye?" It was, and nearby was a big gauzy prom dress in bright mermaid aqua that she danced around the room in, and beside that was a herringbone suit that looked as if it could have been worn on one of the early seasons of Mad Men. Jack put on a Bad Brains vinyl, Ben tried on the suit, some tourists came in to buy postcards, and everything started to feel like a regular Sunday afternoon. But then Ben put his hands into the pockets of the jacket he was peacocking around the store in, daring them to say it was a little tight on him, and Hazel picked up his red blazer, folding it over her arm. Something fell out of one of the pockets. It bounced once on the ground, and then rolled against Jack's shoe. A walnut with a thin bow of grass tied around it.
"Look at that," said Jack, frowning down at her discovery. "What do you think it is?"
"Was it in my coat?" Ben asked.
Hazel nodded.
"Well, let's open it."
Jack slid off the table, a bowler hat sitting cockeyed on his head.
He had a relaxed, loose-limbed way of moving that made Hazel think the exact sort of thoughts that had got her into trouble in the first place. The grass unfurled easily, and the two halves of the walnut came apart. Inside was a small scrap of paper, rolled up like a scroll.
"Let me see," Hazel said, reaching for it.
Unfurling the thin piece of parchment, a shiver went up her spine as she read the spidery lettering. 7 years to pay your debts. Much too late for regrets. They were all silent for a long moment, and Hazel concentrated on not dropping the paper.
"That doesn't make sense," said Jack.
"It's probably some old thing a tourist bought in town."
Ben's voice was a little unsteady.
"Bullshit, fake magic fortune walnut."
There was a shop near the end of Main Street called The Cunning Woman that sold souvenirs to fairy seekers. Incense, bags of salt mixed with red berries for protection, maps to sacred fairy sites around town, crystals, hand-painted tarot cards, and iridescent window dazzlers. Cryptic fairy notes in nuts was the sort of thing they might carry.
"What kind of fortune is that?" Jack asked.
"Yeah," Hazel added, trying to sound as if her heart weren't thundering, trying to behave as though she didn't know for whom the note had been meant, pretending everything was still normal.
"Yeah."
Ben put the shell and the note back in his pocket with a little laugh.
"Creepy, though."
After that, Hazel could only pretend to be having fun. She watched Ben and Jack, memorizing them, memorizing the people and the place, the smell of old books, and the sounds of normal stuff. Ben bought a polka-dot bow tie, and then they walked over to the general store, where Hazel picked up the carton of milk and loaf of bread. Jack was heading back to his parents for dinner because they had a tradition of playing family board games on Sundays, and no matter how dorky Jack or Carter felt that was, neither was allowed to skip out on it. Hazel and Ben went home, too. Outside their front door, Hazel squatted to pour a little milk into the ceramic bowl Mom kept next to the stone walk. Everyone in Fairfold left food out for the fairies, to show them respect, to gain their favor. But the milk glubbed out in thick chunks. It had already gone sour.
Chapter 4. That night, Hazel tossed and turned, kicking the sheets, willing herself not to worry about promises made and debts coming due. She imagined them away, bound up in 100 barnacle-encrusted safes, 1,000 buried chests, chains tight around every one. In the morning, her limbs felt heavy. When she rolled over to hit the snooze on her phone alarm, her fingertips stung. Her palms looked red and abraded. There was a splinter of glass the length of a pin nestled under the swell of her thumb, and a few smaller shining splinters scattered across her fingers. Her heart began to race. She kicked off the covers, frowning, only to find that her feet were caked in mud. Chunks of it dropped off her toes as she got up. Dirt spatter clung to her leg, all the way to her knee. The hem of her nightgown was stiff and filthy. When she pulled back the sheet, her bedclothes looked like a nest with grass and sticks everywhere. She tried to think back to the night before, but there were only vague dreams. The more she concentrated on them, the more they receded. What had happened? What had she done, and why couldn't she remember any of it? Hazel forced herself into the shower, turning the tap to as hot as she could stand it. Under the water, she was able to work glass splinters out of her hand, tiny beads of blood swirling away down the drain. She was able to wash away the mud and to stop trembling. But she was still no closer to having any answers. What had she done? Her muscles hurt as though she'd strained them. But that and the dirt and the shards of glass didn't add up to anything. She was breathing too fast, no matter how much she tried to tell herself to be calm. No matter how much she tried to tell herself that she'd known this was coming, that the hardest part was waiting, and that she ought to be glad that she could finally get it over with. 5 years ago, when Hazel was nearly 11 years old, she'd made a bargain with the folk. She had crept down to the hawthorn tree on a full moon night, just before dawn. The sky was still mostly dark, still dusted with stars. Strips of cloth fluttered from the branches above her, the ghosts of wishes. She'd left her sword at home, out of respect, and hoped that even though she'd hunted some of the folk, the bad ones,